Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoy today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. Each podcast is going to explore a different topic related to heritage conservation in different regions of Ontario. The podcast will include a brief history of the building, interviews with people who have some connection to this space, but the ultimate goal is to try and tell stories about the buildings, stories about the space that most people don't know. Each one is going to be different, because the truth is, each building has a different past, and each building has a different story to tell us. So without further ado, let's get started on today's topic. Today we head to Canada's 15th largest municipality and the largest municipality in southwestern Ontario. It has the nickname the Forest City. Do you know where I'm talking about? Let me give you some more clues. Originally, the land would have been a dense hardwood forest, and archaeological findings suggest that Aboriginal peoples would have resided in the area for at least 10,000 years. The area would have seen the arrival of European settlers in the early 1800s. It would become a village in 1826 and incorporated as a city in 1855. Today, it has a very healthy population of over 350,000 people and is located halfway between Toronto and Detroit, Michigan. Do you know where I'm talking about now? If you guess London, Ontario, then you're right. With such a rich history, there are many historic buildings in London, but the building we're going to talk about today is found in the heart of the downtown, and it takes up an entire city block. It is known as the London Life Building, because it has been, and continues to be, the headquarters and office space for the London Life Insurance Company. Now, when London Life Insurance was founded in 1874, the company spent the first 32 years of business in a rented building and moved into its first permanent building in 1906. The 1906 building was located at 424 Wellington Street and still exists today. It is better known as the Wright Lithographing Building. Over the next decade and a half, many things happened that catapulted the success and growth of the company, but one event in particular would change the pathway of the company forever. It was the results of a royal commission the government of the day had commissioned to investigate the insurance industry in Canada. Now, the commission was called because numerous companies, some of which were Canadian, had been exposed as having improper business practices south of the border. As the London Life website history page says, and I quote, "London Life emerged from the inquiry not only unscathed, but upheld as an outstanding example of a properly run company," end quote. To say this resulted in a massive boom in business is an understatement. The London Life Insurance Company catapulted from a $10 million business in 1906 to a $296 million business a mere 20 years later. With this kind of growth, the employee roster also grew from 22 employees to 250. It's no wonder that by 1922, it had outgrown its first home on Wellington Street and started to look for a place to expand. Now, thanks to the forward thinking of the company's first president, Mr. Joseph Jeffrey, who had been purchasing the land that makes up its current location, the company had a spot in mind and were ready for the expansion. The City of London, though, had some hesitations about the move, fearing that the large building would mar the serene environment of Victoria Park, which is found directly north of the property line. The resistance from the city at the time almost backfired, as other cities such as Toronto and Hamilton began courting London Life, welcoming them to do business in their cities and urging them to relocate. All of this information and more can be found on the company's webpage, but I wanted to see the building for myself. So I went down to London and had the pleasure of speaking with Don Spanner, who is the company archivist for London Life. Don knows a lot about the history of the building, so we'll pick up on our conversation that day from the point where the City of London had just gotten on board to allow the building.
City Council came to their senses. They realized that they may lose the city business, lose employees, above all tax revenues, and they relented and finally allowed London Life to relocate. So the result, and I give lots of tours to people about this building, the result was this magnificent four-story L-shaped building that looks out over Victoria Park. It's quite a special building. It's built of Queenston stone on the first floor and Indiana limestone on the remaining three floors. And the architectural style is what is known as modified Greek. When you come up to the front entrance, you'll see a portico of four columns overlooking the front entrance, and there's half columns across the facade of the building between the windows right across. And throughout the building, inside, the interior trim was actually steel. It looks like mahogany, but it's steel with a mahogany finish. And the floors were all travertine marble. Wainscoting throughout is white marble. The building also boasts a very large auditorium on the fourth floor, which is still extensively used today. And the other interesting feature, which unfortunately we don't have anymore, but when they built the building in 1926, they actually installed a four-lane bowling alley in the basement for staff and their families and friends.
Now stop here to explain that Don was speaking only about the original L-shaped building built in 1926. This first building was not the full vision of architect Roy Moore, but rather what you see today from the street is the whole vision he had in mind. The completed building would eventually be realized with the 1952 add-on. Now most people don't know that the Dufferin Street entrance is open to the public, so I encourage you to take a journey inside. If you do, you're in for a treat, since they don't make lobbies like this anymore. As you walk through the large and heavy solid brass doors, look up and you will see two stained glass pieces that depict two knights. It is said that the knights are there to protect the company's investments. There's a small room just to the right of the entrance, which offers visitors a little history of the space and a snapshot of the exhibit of the moment. The permanent part of the display shows a large photo of some of the original employees and a visual of what the entrance would have looked like back in the day. It would have been much like a bank, with a doorman who greeted you and wickets you interacted through. A piece of the original wicket is on display in the visitors' room for you to see. Now, I asked Don if anyone famous was associated with the building or if any interesting events took place, and he had these wonderful stories to offer.
Well, we've had some rather interesting London Life employees who've made their name elsewhere. Back in the 1930s, there was a gentleman by the name of Ross Sandy Somerville. He went by the name Sandy Somerville. And he had a long career with London Life. But during the 1930s, he was the Tiger Woods of his day. This was around the time when professional golf was just starting to take off, so the big events were still the U.S. Amateur Open and the British Amateur Open. And he had won the U.S. Amateur Open in 1932, as well as numerous Canadian amateur titles. Another fellow of interest, still living, I understand, is a fellow by the name of Cliff McWhorter, who was another longtime London Life employee, and he was a well-known bantamweight professional boxer in the 1930s. As for events, probably the most significant historical event or event that I can talk about is really the famed wartime dance troupe, the London Life Troopers, who trained and rehearsed in the company's auditorium. They were financed fully by the company, and they were really a consequence of City Council's request after the outbreak of World War II for local businesses to assist with the war effort. So, this council was struck by City Hall. They went around to local industries, businesses, and essentially said, what can you do to help us with the war effort? So our response was to create a troop show, one that would entertain the many troops that were stationed all across Ontario in the Air and Army bases, prepping for the D-Day invasion. And these men and women, as you can appreciate, they were far from home, lonely. They needed some entertainment to get them away from the drudgery of military training. So that was our goal, was to provide them with this entertainment. And in doing so, a local high school music teacher by the name of Don Wright, after which the Western's Faculty of Music is named, he was hired as orchestra leader and producer of the show. And so he was the only external person that was involved in the Troopers. There was one more external person, and that person's name was Louise Wright. She was a former rockette from Radio City Music Hall. She had a dance studio in Toronto. And she was brought in to train the troopers, who were all London Life staff, how to dance. She was known as a swing dancer, and she knew all the steps. So overall, during the years they performed during the war from 1941 to 1944, they gave something like over 85 performances to something like over 100,000 servicemen and women. And if you talk to those veterans who are still with us today from Ontario, they still remember the troopers. They were very highly revered, and from what I hear, it was one of the best shows around.
Don has spent a lot of time combing through the history of the building, so I asked him if there were any special or unique stories that most people don't know. And here's what he had to say.
Well, yes, there's one really special story I'd like to relate, and this has to do again with the Second World War. As I mentioned earlier, I think the Jeffrey family ran London Life. During World War II, there was one of the Jeffreys, Captain Joe Jeffrey, who was the last Jeffrey to run London Life. During the war, he was Secretary of the Naval Board in Halifax. And he was in charge of naval intelligence, specifically the movement of convoys across the Atlantic to supply and support the Allied cause against Germany. Now, interestingly, but not surprisingly, Jeffrey was a friend of Winnipeg-born Sir William Stevenson. Some of you may know that name. He was known as a man called Intrepid. He was the Canadian spy master, who was essentially responsible for breaking the Nazi intelligence codes and running his spy organization out of the Rockefeller Center in New York City. And what a lot of people don't know is that many of the women who worked for Stevenson's organization in New York were women from the insurance industry. And this was largely because of Captain Joe Jeffrey's doing. You know, he knew Stevenson. And Stevenson felt that such women understood the importance of security and confidentiality. And indeed, there were some women from London Life who actually left the company to go and work for Stevenson during the war. I've had an opportunity to interview at least one of them. And there were others that came from insurance companies in Toronto. I know of one woman who works here at London Life whose mother worked for an insurance company in Toronto, and she worked for Stevenson as well at the time she was recruited. So that's kind of an interesting little tidbit that a lot of people don't know about.
As a young professional woman, I must admit that I couldn't help but notice that there are many historical photos on display that represented a large amount of female workers. Now, for those who visit the building as part of London's Doors Open, you too will get a chance to see these photos and take a tour of the auditorium, which is generally not open to the public. I don't want to give away too much information about all the photos on display, but I can tell you that one of them, which depicts the staff picnic down in Port Stanley, is so well produced you can see details of buttons and embroidery on women's blouses. Another photo shows a picture of the Lieutenant Governor of Ontario when they came to open the building. They even have a piece of the original ribbon that was cut that day and the Bible that was used to bless the building on display. Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast today. The London Life Building will be open to the public at the annual Doors Open Festival. You can also learn more by going to the Building Stories website, which is www.buildingstories.co. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you goes out to the Architecture Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Centre at the University of Waterloo, the Centre for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments about today's show, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories. And of course, you can also find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.